PA Books is a production of PCN, a nonprofit television network. Listeners like you make our programming possible. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
Welcome to the PA Books Podcast. I'm Phil Beckman. PA Books features interviews with authors of Pennsylvania history, culture, and people. In this episode, we talk with Dennis Snelling about his book, The Whiz Kids, How the 1950 Phillies Took the Pennant, Lost the World Series, and Changed Philadelphia Baseball Forever.
This week on PA Books, Dennis Snelling, author of The Whiz Kids.
Dennis Snelling is the author of The Whiz Kids, How the 1950s Phillies Took the Pennant, Lost the World Series, and Changed Philadelphia Baseball Forever. Dennis, what drew you to this 1950 Phillies team?
Well, I've always been a big fan of baseball history. Even when I was young, when I first started following the game in my preteen years. And so certain things stood out, and one of the things was the Phillies having been in only two World Series prior to 1980. And losing both of them and only winning one game out of the eight. And in fact, they had, I believe, lost 7 one-run games in a row in the World Series prior to finally winning the series in 1980. And so that combined with the fascination of how they were almost treated as if they were revered, almost as if they had won the World Series in a lot of ways. And I can only think of a couple of other teams like that, the 1959 Chicago White Sox, who were called the Go-Go Sox, and the 1967 Impossible Dream Red Sox, were also treated with that same kind of reverence. But the difference was that this 1950 Phillies team was really built to be a winner, whereas I think the other two were kind of accidental champions and kind of captured people's fancy. But the 50 Phillies were built over several years. And it was fascinating why they won and then why they didn't win again. So it was a chance to look at what goes into trying to build a dynasty and what goes wrong where it doesn't become one.
Well, take us back to the beginning of the club. When was it founded, and what were the decades like leading up to, say, the 1940s?
Sure. The team was founded in 1883, kind of replacing a Philadelphia team that had actually started in 1876, the first year of the National League, but was kicked out along with New York that first year for not finishing the season. And the American Association, a rival major league, had a Philadelphia franchise. So around that time, the National League booted two teams that were located in Troy, New York, and Worcester, Massachusetts, and replaced them with Philadelphia and New York. And so that's when the Phillies started. They were founded by a local businessman named John Rogers and a former athlete and star and sporting goods magnate, Al Reach. And they owned the team up through the early 1900s. For about 20 years, they owned the ball club. And the Phillies of the 1800s were always really good, really supported by the fan base. They were almost always first or second in attendance. And they had a lot of great players. They had an outfield that all three players hit 400 or better. And actually the team's leading hitter was the fourth outfielder who hit like 418 and 340 something at bats. They had a great player, the Babe Ruth or Otani of his day, two-way player named Charlie Ferguson, who was one of the best pitchers in the league and the team's best hitter. He would often play second base or the outfield when he wasn't pitching. And unfortunately, he died of typhoid fever shortly after his fourth season. The Phillies had an amazing ballpark, but it burned down in the 1890s and was replaced by what later became known as Baker Bowl in 1895. And then the team went through a series of owners in the early 1900s. Some were kind of funded by other franchises secretly. One of the owners of the Cubs had a part of the Phillies, but kind of kept that under wraps. You had an owner who was eventually kicked out of baseball. He tried to rename the team the Live Wires, and his name was Horace Fogle, and he tried to pick a fight with the National League and ended up getting kicked out of baseball after accusing the league wanting the New York Giants to win the pennant. But he did build the Phillies' first pennant winner. He acquired Grover Cleveland Alexander, for instance, and put together the core of the team that became its first pennant winner in 1915. And that team by that time was owned by William Baker. But Baker was never that interested in the team, eventually broke it up around 1917, and didn't really have the money to compete. And when he died in 1930, the Phillies hadn't had a winning season since that 1917 season. Ball club was turned over to a husband and wife ownership team, the Nugents, who were savvy baseball people, understood talent, but again, didn't have the money to really run the team, and generally would sign young players and then turn around and sell them. And that was kind of the modus operandi for three decades. And ultimately, the Phillies didn't have a winning season between 1918 and 1948 and finished last in earned run average, I think, all but two of those seasons. And eventually the fan base drifted away because the rival American League came in the early 1900s, and the Philadelphia Athletics were founded by Connie Mack and really became the dominant franchise, while the Phillies were kind of an afterthought. And by the 1930s, it was kind of a falling down ballpark with when they had a good player, they were getting rid of them. And the team eventually went into kind of receivership with the National League, bringing in an owner named William Cox in 1943. And he kind of turned around the idea of just getting rid of young players. He acquired some, but at the same time, he was gambling on his own team, and by the end of the first year was kicked out of baseball, banned for life. He was one of the men recently reinstated along with Pete Rose and Shoeless Joe Jackson, as a matter of fact. But he was banned for life from baseball, and at that point, that's when the Carpenter family purchased the ball club. The father purchased it, and the son, 28-year-old Bob Carpenter Jr., was tasked to run it day to day. And they brought in a longtime family friend named Herb Pennock, a former Hall of Fame pitcher, to become general manager. And that's when the modern era of the Phillies really started.
Well, let's talk about Bob Carpenter. So he's 28 years old, but he's also in the Army at the time. Right. How did he manage his responsibilities as team president with being in the Army?
Well, he did it on leave occasionally. And, you know, he was 28 years old. He was in boot camp when the team was first acquired. But Herb Pennock really ran the team the first year or so. But Carpenter still communicated with the press. He set certain rules when he did come out on leave and be able to be a part of the franchise. And he talked about saying that he would always be honest with the reporters as long as they were honest with him, and he'd be open with them until they gave him reason not to. And he also decided to try to rename the team and put together a contest that resulted in the Phillies being renamed the Blue Jays, which then created a bunch of controversy. So he said, no, we'll have two nicknames. So they were the kind of the Blue Jays and the Phillies from 1944 until about 1949.
And for this competition, who won? Who was the person that won?
So a woman named Edna Crooks, she and her husband were caretakers, I think, at the International Odd Fellows Hall. And she was one of seven people who came up with the winning nickname of Blue Jays. And she felt the Blue Jays had a fighting spirit and really reflected the way the team would turn itself around after four decades of mediocrity.
So as Bob Carpenter takes control of the team, you mentioned before that this was a team, the 1950 team, was built to be a champion. So talk about the process in the late 1940s after World War II, where they're working at building this team.
So one of the things that they decided to do was really build a farm system, a coaching staff that taught, and a scouting group that knew how to evaluate talent and train that talent. And so they brought in a fellow named Joe Reardon, that Herb Pennock had worked with the Boston Red Sox. They created schools around the country to recruit players and train them. They went out and signed bonus baby players, as they would call them then. They signed a lot of young talent and didn't spare any expense to do so, battling the Yankees and Dodgers and Giants to do that. And signed players like Kurt Simmons, who was signed after a tryout where the Phillies were so interested in Simmons that they actually bussed the team up on an off day to Egypt, Pennsylvania, near Allentown, and played in the ballpark there with Simmons pitching for a local town team, mostly made up of high schoolers, against the Phillies, battled them to a 4-4 tie, actually. And they signed Robin Roberts out of Michigan State. They signed Richie Ashburn, who was actually a catcher when they signed him, and a couple of other teams had tried to sign him, and those contracts had been voided by the commissioner because there were some things that were not legal in the contracts. So he kind of fell into the Phillies' lap. And they were just very successful in finding that talent. And the thing that was also different was they had the money and the means to keep them and did so. And so that's really, they built that team mostly from the ground up. There were a couple of players, Andy Semenuk and Dell Ennis, that actually came from the Cox regime. There were a couple of trades going into the 1950 season. They were made. Dick Sisler was one. Eddie Waitkus was another, which, of course, in his first season, he was there was an attempted murder of him in the hotel. In 49, he made a great comeback in 1950. But most of the players were signed by the Phillies and stayed with them. And that was really the difference from what had happened before. And that really came from Bob Carpenter's money and commitment, and Herb Pennock's know-how and that philosophy of what they wanted to do.
Now, you mentioned Eddie Waitkus and the attempted murder against him. Ruth Ann Steinhagen was the person who pulled the trigger on that. Tell that story. What happened?
So Ruth Ann Steinhagen was obviously insane, and she had had previous crushes on an actor and another ball player, but fell in love with Waitkus when he was playing for the Chicago Cubs. She saw him and just obsessed with him and would pretend to have conversations with him as she went down the street. She never met him, and he had never met her, didn't know who she was. And when he was traded to the Phillies, that didn't change her viewpoint of him. She still obsessed over him. She had pictures spread all around her room. As a difference in how mental health is dealt with these days, her mother was aware that she had a fixation, and in fact, that her daughter had talked about wanting to kill Waitkus so no one else could have him, and was concerned about it, but didn't really do a whole lot. And she had a friend who went with her when Ruth went and bought a gun. And one of the quotes was, yeah, she bought it for $25 and the bullets were extra, I think. And that was kind of the extent of her concern about it. And so when he was traded to the Phillies, they made a return to Chicago, and she was going to check into the hotel and set up a situation where she could meet him. But the hotel was sold out. So it actually was the second trip in to Chicago by the Phillies. And she basically had this gun that she got into the hotel. It was a rifle that was, she disassembled it, and she had a knife in her pocket. And the idea was she was going to stab Waitkus and then shoot herself. So she left a note. Waitkus, after the game that day, went out with a couple of the other ball players, came back to the hotel late, and there was a note left for him that Ruth Ann Burns, she used a different name, had something of importance to tell him. And he called her and made the fateful decision to go up and see what was going on. He walks in the room, goes, so what's this matter of importance? And she takes the gun out of the closet. He'd moved so fast, she didn't stab him. She was kind of surprised at actually seeing him there and said, "You've been bothering me for 2 years. I have a surprise for you. Now you're going to die." And she shot him in the chest. And then she panicked and ended up running down the hall. She could hear his moaning and called the front desk and said, "A man's been shot. You need to get a doctor up here." And that probably saved his life. He probably would have died at that point. And so it was obviously a traumatic event for Eddie Wakis. He missed the rest of that season and then made a comeback in 1950. But, you know, the story has some parallels to a novel that came out about 3 years later called The Natural. And while the author of that has never said what his inspiration was, the timing of it and some of the similarities of it to the novel have always kind of fostered that speculation that it was part of The Natural.
Now, in 1948, Eddie Sawyer became the general manager. What impact did he have on the team?
So Eddie Sawyer was, he was actually a college professor, and which was unusual at the time. He was an excellent ball player who had gotten to the top rung of the minor leagues in the late 1930s for an injury, basically derailed his career, a knee injury. And so he came in, he had managed many of the young players in the minor leagues at both Utica and then Toronto, which was the Phillies' top farm team. And so when he came in 58, he was replacing Ben Chapman, who had been kind of a fiery manager and more of a good old boys network with his coach Dusty Cook. They were more of that old fashioned manager and coach situation. And he brought in some other coaches and basically changed the attitude from a fiery attitude to, you know, "We're going to be more professional. I'm going to treat you like men." And it helped them grow up and grow into a really great team. And he wasn't unwilling to do some unusual things, like Mike Goliad, who ended up playing second base, had never played second base before. A couple of weeks before he got up to the Phillies, they needed a second baseman, moved him from third base. Willie Jones was signed originally as a shortstop, and he came up and played third base. He moved Dick Sisler into left field and played him. So he was, and Jim Constanti, who only threw basically change-ups and then slower change-ups. He saw something in him. And Jim Constanti, who is an interesting guy in and of himself, a veteran, one of the older players, whose career was saved by his next door neighbor, an undertaker, whose background in athletics was in bowling, but he became Constanti's personal pitching coach. And Constanti had an incredible season, pitching over 160 innings, winning 16 games, saving 22 others, saving, pitching 8, 9, and 10 innings in some of these relief appearances. And so he was willing to look past the traditional and try things. Richie Ashburn, moving him from catcher to outfield. And so I think it was that he was unconventional and willing to try things and see if they worked. And then I think the initial way that he treated his players, they really responded to, especially coming out of the previous couple of managers.
So as Carpenter is implementing this larger strategy to build a team, was he seeing results in 1947, 48, and 49?
Really not until about 48. The war, of course, interrupted some of that. It was tough to sign young talent in 44 and 45. And so they were still signing players like Schoolboy Rowe, who was a veteran pitcher from the 1930s, who was one of the key players on the team, and you know, they had a lot of older players because of that. So it really, they really couldn't get going the way they wanted to until about 46 and 47. 49 was when they really made the move, when they finished third place. And Sawyer addressed the team at the end of that season and said, "Hey, come back next year ready to win the pennant." And there was a point in May of 49 when one of the coaches, Cy Perkins, was talking to Major McDonald, one of the other coaches, during a workout. and watching the players and said, hey, Mage, these guys are going to win the pennant next year. So they could see something was happening. But the fan attendance was good. And they saw, I think fans responded to the fact that the team was signing young players and holding on to them. But a lot of the talent didn't reach there until about 1948. And it really started gelling probably in 49.
You mentioned that there was starting to be this feeling that this team could win. And was that a big cultural change for the franchise?
Oh, yes. Because, you know, nobody hadn't had a winning season between 1918 and 1948. 31 straight seasons, not being in the first division and not having a record above 500. Or they had one record above 500. But they finished, I think that was in 1932, but they had not finished in the first division since 1917, when you get to 1949. So yes, it was a big cultural change. And the thing that excited Philadelphia fans was the Athletics had also gone through a down period of about a dozen years after Connie Mack broke up the great 1929 and 1931 teams. And they were actually on the rebound. And 1950 was interesting because it was coming into Connie Mack's 50th season as manager of the A's. So there was great expectation that both teams might contend, which was unheard of in Philadelphia at that time.
Well, let's go to the start of the 1950 season. Pitchers and catchers are reporting. What is that like for the team?
Well, certainly the Eddie Waitkus situation was probably the one that overshadowed everything. Would he be able to come back? And it had a lot to do with what the lineup would look like. Was Dick Sisler going to come back and play first base as he had the year before? And he wasn't that great a first baseman. Eddie Waitkus was a fantastic defensive first baseman. You could almost never get the ball past him. And he was also great at... He had three different infielders who threw to first three different ways, but he could handle them all. And he was really kind of a bulwark there. And then the other big story was probably Richie Ashburn, who broke in 1948, was Rookie of the Year, had a fantastic season, led the major leagues in stolen bases, even though he broke his ankle, or broke his hand, I'm sorry, broke his thumb, sliding into second base in August and missed the last 30 or 40 games of that year. But in 1949, he himself later said he got swell-headed and he had not had a great season in second season. And so another thing that Eddie Sawyer tended to do is he would create contests. He would not just hand a player a position. That happened with Eddie Waitkus, just because Eddie Waitkus was trying to make a comeback, he bet Eddie Waitkus that Dick Sisler would be in the lineup opening day to motivate Waitkus. He brought in Ed Sinicki, a young outfielder who had broken at the end of 1949 and hit three home runs in September and was a great center fielder with a stronger arm than Ashburn had, with the idea that he would challenge Ashburn in center field. And so Ashburn got the message, had a great spring. Sinicki, who is a notoriously slow starter, did not play as great in spring and went back to Toronto. But even then, it wasn't set. Ashburn was actually benched for about a week and a half at the end of April because he was hitting about 300, but he had no extra base hits. And again, because he didn't have a strong arm, that was a problem. So they used Dick Whitman for a little while, but then went back to Ashburn. So those are some of the things that were kind of set up and were probably the big stories in 1950. But everybody recognized Robin Roberts was really a coming player. Kurt Simmons kind of came out of nowhere. He had disappointing seasons in 48 and 49 because he'd been a bonus baby. The rules required that he be on the major league team during those 2 years, and he struggled a little bit. But he really exploded in 1950. And they were coming in. They had two other players who had won 17 games in 49, Russ Meyer and Kent Heinzelman. And so with Roberts, there was some hope that, okay, we've got a shot at this. Everyone knew the Dodgers was kind of the team to beat, but, you know, Sawyer didn't want them resting on their laurels in 49, made sure there was some competition. Those were probably the big stories in spring training. And then everybody recognized, hey, they're holding on to the young players, and these young players are players who are going to get better each year.
We'll be back in a moment with the PA Books Podcast.
Enjoying this podcast? Please support PCN with a donation at PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
The baseball season is long, and so there are ups and downs for any team during the season. Take us into the beginning part. Did the team come out strong? How are they performing early in the year?
They performed pretty well from the beginning, but it was like a 3 or 4 team battle for most of the way through July, where it was their team, the Dodgers, the Giants, and to a lesser extent, Boston. St. Louis was also, the Cardinals were also kind of in there early. In August, the Phillies just broke away, and they opened up a lead of about 7 games towards the end of August and held that through early September, about mid-September. And it really looked like they were a shoe-in at that point to win. But as later Phillies fans in 1964 would recognize, nothing's safe when you get into that last couple of weeks of September. But they played solid. Their offense was great. The pitching, especially Roberts and Simmons, were trading the lead in the major leagues in wins, and Constante was coming in behind them. And then they had a couple of rookies that showed up mid-year, Bubba Church and Bob Miller, who really became revelations and pitched great. They just kept building and building in momentum, and then finally broke loose in August.
So take us into the end of that season as they're coming up, and they eventually win the pennant, of course. But what was that last period like?
So there were some things that happened to them down the stretch. Dick Sisler injured his wrist and had to miss a little bit of time. One of the things that's amazing when you look at the team is how many players played nearly every game. Eddie Wakis, making his comeback, I think played in 154. They played 157 games that year because there were 3 ties. It's a 154 game season. Normally, Granny Hamner, short, Willie Jones, all the players played almost every game. Sisler missed a few. And then they went through a really devastating round that decimated the pitching staff. The first thing that happened was Kurt Simmons, who was in the National Guard, and his unit was called to duty. It was the second time he had left, and he was leading the majors with 17 wins at that point. I think Roberts had 16. And they were both trying to become the first 20-game winner that the Phillies had in over 3 decades, since Grover Cleveland Alexander. And so he had been called up in August for a couple of weeks. He'd been called up in 49, actually, also. But the Korean War was getting underway, and so there were activations in military units, and Simmons was called active duty, I think, on the 10th of September, 9th or 10th of September. But within a week after that, Bubba Church was hit by a line drive back that nearly took his eye out. In fact, at one point, he thought he had lost his eye. It was a line drive hit by Ted Kluszewski. The next day, Bob Miller, who had won his first, I believe, 8 or 9 games of the year as a starter. He was either 8-0 or 9-0. He had injured his back in July going to a train station ahead of the Phillies to get into Boston a day ahead of them and get some rest. And then he started favoring that and injured his shoulder. And the day after Church was injured, Miller's shoulder basically froze up. So all of a sudden, the Phillies had lost 3 of their starting pitchers going down the stretch. But the other thing that happened to them is they stopped hitting. They just really hit a slump. I think they were shut out 3 times through August. I think they were shut out 7 times in September. And so they just ran into a slump at the wrong time and a pitching staff that couldn't dominate. And that lead whittled away. They were 7.5 games ahead with 11 games to play, and it went right down to the very last day.
How did this team's success impact the fan base in Philadelphia?
Well, I mean, I think it was exciting. The same thing we were talking about the Athletics. The Athletics actually collapsed that year and lost more than 100 games. And so that was, the Phillies were kind of then the focal point. It wasn't, the Athletics weren't the focal point, even though Connie Mack going through his 50th year, and Connie Mack was still the face of Philadelphia baseball. But the Phillies had the attention of everybody. And no Phillies team or Athletics team had won a pennant since 1931. So we're almost two decades since either team had appeared in the World Series. And I think the Phillies were, they shared the stadium. They rented it from the Athletics. They had moved there in 1938 when the Baker Bowl just became finally at a point where it really needed to be abandoned. And so they were kind of the tenants. And yet they ended up being the team that stayed. When you got into the 1950s, the economics of baseball were changing quite a bit. Minor leagues were collapsing. There were a lot of people who came back from the war who were young families who it was a boom time. They had money. And so they were looking, and there was a lot more competition for the entertainment dollar. And so major league attendance was dropping precipitously during this time as well. So there was coming a time that bore fruit in the 1950s, along with some people fighting the antitrust rule that baseball had, that meant two team cities were going to become rare. Today we have Chicago, LA, and New York, but there was also Boston, St. Louis, and Philadelphia at that time. And so one of those teams was probably going to leave, and it might have been the Phillies had they not come up as they did in 1950-51, and they also had more money through the Carpenters than the Macs had with the Athletics. So they captured the fan base at the right time and flipped the switch and became the dominant team in Philadelphia, and the Athletics eventually left in 1955.
So 1950, the Phillies win the pennant, and who do they match up with in the World Series?
Well, the New York Yankees, which, at the time they were not the juggernaut that people thought. There were people who thought that the Phillies could beat them and that the Yankees weren't that good. What people didn't realize at that time was that was the second year of an eventual record 5 straight World Series wins. But nobody knew that at the time. They had won in 49 and they had won in 47. But they had not been as dominant, and they had a manager in his second year named Casey Stengel, who was not the legend yet that he became later. And so Eddie Sawyer, because Robin Roberts had pitched 4 times in the last 8 days of the season, he had started 4 times, decided to go with Jim Constanti to start the game. He was really down to Roberts and Constanti as the only two pitchers he had confidence in. And he thought Constanti would be something different the Yankees had not seen, because he pitched basically forkballs, changeups. He couldn't throw hard, but he had great control and great confidence. He just couldn't shake Constanti. And he had started before in his career, but it had been a while. He was a starting pitcher earlier in his career and made the major leagues, kind of failed, went back to the minors. And like I said, was just about out of baseball when his personal pitching coach helped bail him out. And so he pitched that first game and gave up 1 run early, but only held 1 run, and I believe 4 hits in 8 innings. Pitched a great ball game, but the Phillies couldn't score. And the Yankees won that first game 1-0, and it went from there.
So as the series was unfolding, how well did the Phillies do?
It was a great series for a 4-game sweep, believe it or not. 3 of the games, again, were 1-run ball games. It was 1-0, 2-1, 3-2. And in the third game, the Phillies finally took a lead, but they just could never string hits together. And the last game, they lost 5-2. But they actually had the tying run at the plate in the bottom of the ninth. So it was an exciting series, but in some ways it was tough because September had been so tough on them, and they had to turn right around and take on the Yankees. And then there were no off days in this series. So four games were played in a little more than 72 hours. So it was almost like by the time they settled into play, the series was over. And, you know, I think people don't today don't understand how important starting pitching was in those days, because we don't see starting pitchers go 9-10 innings. Robin Roberts went 10 innings in the second game. And that was not unusual back then. Robin Roberts would pitch 300 innings every year for five or six straight years. And so them not having the starting pitching was a real handicap, where the Yankees, you know, had Ali Reynolds, and they had Vic Rashi, and they had, and then they had a young rookie named Whitey Ford who pitched game four. And so they just, I think, had more pitching than the Phillies had, and it was definitely a pitcher's series. It was not a hitter's series.
Was there a sense when the season was over that this was a team built for the future?
Yes. You know, Connie Mack made the comment that this team is, the Phillies were wonderful and they're going to win for the next 6 years. Some of that was probably hyperbole, but people really thought the Phillies were for real and that they were going to keep winning. And, you know, there was kind of a cottage industry in the mid-50s when they didn't, asking why, because they had this core of young players. And in fact, they kept most of that core together. But what happened is their farm system stopped producing, and they just never found the pitching to come back that they had in 1950. Kurt Simmons missed another year because of military service. He didn't get back till 1952. A couple of the other pitchers, Constanti, that was a career year. He never had another year like that. And just circumstances didn't come together, and the farm system for the first half of the 1950s just did not produce.
So one of the key events that happens during this period, in 1947, Jackie Robinson enters Major League Baseball. And how would that impact the Phillies franchise?
Well, there's a pretty famous battle between him and Ben Chapman, who was manager of the Phillies at the time, where there was a lot of unfortunate language spewed from the dugout in Robinson's direction. Chapman tried to dismiss it as that's just regular bench jockeying, but I don't think most people thought it was, I think most people even at the time thought it probably crossed a line. And it definitely colored people's perceptions of the Phillies when it came to race. And there were problems into the 1950s with the Phillies trying to sign black players. One of their head scouts, Chuck Ward, said he was told by some black players that they had been told by others, don't sign with the Phillies because they don't like black players. And the fact that they were very slow to integrate anyway added to that perception, true or not. And, you know, the Phillies tried to keep doing the same things in the early 50s that they did in the late 40s, which is going out and signing bonus babies from high school. And they weren't as successful. Herb Pennock died in 1948, so Bob Carpenter ran the team without a general manager up until 1954. And I think they paid the price for that and never could get back to the level that they had. And by the end of the decade, well, Eddie Sawyer was fired. Eddie Sawyer comes back in 1958, and they end up in last place. And they had started the decade at the top and ended it up back at the bottom.
Now, your book is titled The Whiz Kids. When did that term come into use?
Well, it really, that spring training in 1950. They had been called the Fightin' Phillies some the year before, and Bob Carpenter finally abandoned the Blue Jays after the 1949 season and made the comment, that really doesn't characterize us. We're more Whiz Kids or Fightin' Phillies. That's who we are. Whiz Kids kind of dated back to, there was a college basketball team in Illinois in the early 1940s. I think Andy Hansen was the big star, and they'd been called the Whiz Kids. So it was kind of, came from partially from that, but you started seeing Whiz Kids used. WizKids and Fightin' Phillies was kind of used interchangeable all during the 1950 season. WizKids, you first started seeing in Florida in March, you would start seeing that nickname kind of applied to them.
So as the 1950s wears on, what happens to Bob Carpenter?
Well, he continues owning the team into the 1970s. When he finally turned the team over, I think in 72, somewhere in the early 70s, to his son, who ran it into 1980, I believe, and then sold it to Bill Giles, who ran it from there for a while. So he continued. His father died, I think, a year after he took over the ball club. So he basically was running it. His family, his father had married into the DuPont family, so that's where their money came from. And he continued to run the Phillies for the next couple of decades, and you know, but never got that World Series.
The Athletics would eventually leave Philadelphia. What happened?
So the Max, basically, there was kind of a family schism where you had Connie was married twice, one to his first wife died young, but he had a couple of kids from that marriage and then had some younger sons. And there was some battles there. And really, that's all. The ball club was the only source of income they really had. Connie had some private investments, but for the most part, if the team wasn't doing well, they weren't doing well financially. And when the team looked like in 50, if you look at 48 and 49, they really made a run at, you know, they were in the first division and looked like they were really turning things around. And so Connie, even being 87 years old at the time, they decided to put some money into players, and the pitching just collapsed. They had a lot of pitching injuries. And so they collapsed. Connie backed away from managing. The sons tried to run the team. Some were more interested in running it than others. There was kind of battles between them. And so between the lack of funds and the lack of vision, a single vision, it basically, they ran out of gas. At one point, they had reached agreement to sell to a local group that would keep the team in Philadelphia. But one of the sons kind of betrayed everybody else and had kind of a side deal with a man named Arnold Johnson, who owned Yankee Stadium. And he sold that and moved the team to Kansas City in 1955.
Do you have a favorite player from the 1950 season?
Well, Constanti certainly is up there. I mean, there's just a lot of, you know, Andy Semenik was really the rock on that team, played the last 2 weeks of the season and the World Series essentially on a broken ankle on a play at home played against the Giants. Monty Irvin, you know, had a collided with him at home plate and to gut it out like that. You know, Dick Sisler, very interesting. You know, you got to talk about that last game of the 1950 season, which was so dramatic. And Sisler hitting the home run that gets them into the series. But there were really three things that, I mean, it looked like they were going to collapse. And you think of the pressure on Robin Roberts pitching the fourth time in 8 days. And Sisler had three hits early in the game. But the Phillies took a 1-0 lead. They were playing at Brooklyn. They'd lost 6.5 of their 7.5 game lead. And if they lost, they were going to face a 3-game playoff against the Dodgers. And you have Roberts pitching, like I said, against Don Newcomb. And they had met several times during the year, both of them going for their 20th win. Roberts, for the sixth time, trying to become a 20-game winner. A very frustrating September. And they take a 1-0 lead, and then Pee Wee Reese hits this ball that lands on a ledge in front of a screen out of the reach of Del Ennis, the outfielder for the Phillies. And it just spins and stops there. And all I can do is look at the ball while Reese runs around the bases. Under the ground rules, it was a live ball, but he couldn't reach it. And you got to think, as a Phillies fan, this just is not gonna work. And as a Phillies player and the pressure that had to put on them, and they battle into the 10th inning, and then Sisler hits this, well, actually in the bottom of the ninth, the Dodgers get two on with nobody out, and a ball's hit to center fielder Richie Ashburn, who did not have a great arm, and he throws out Cal Abrams trying to score in what would have won the game for the Dodgers. That dramatic notion, and Bert Schotten afterwards saying, how could Richie Ashburn never threw out anybody at home plate? How could he have done that? Well, actually, Schotten should have read his scouting reports a little better. I looked it up, and Ashburn had thrown four players out at home plate in his career to that point, including one just a week before when he threw out Eddie Stanky at home plate. But he did not have a great arm, but he was playing shallow, and the Phillies were also playing close to second base, and the third base coach just thought he'd try it. And they still had to get out of the inning, and Roberts did. And then Sisler hits the dramatic three-run home run. And the Philadelphia fans in Philadelphia, this game's played in Brooklyn, the whole town of Philadelphia goes nuts. And you just think about all those little moments that had to all come together perfect for one of the great moments in baseball history, especially Philadelphia history, and what the emotion and energy that unleashed that moment. It's just amazing to see that all come together.
How has the 1950s Phillies team been remembered over the years? Was it a team that was remembered fondly, or was it kind of forgotten?
No, it was remembered fondly. It's still remembered. This year's the 75th anniversary, and the Phillies had a special recognition, although all the players are gone now. They had a special recognition for them this year, at one of the games, I think in August. And there were reunions constantly starting in 1963 up until 2000, where they would have honor the team. Of course, it became less and less of an event, more of a side event later. But the first one in 1963, Jim Constante arrives by helicopter to pitch relief in this game. And most of the players are there. And, you know, it's really an event. As time goes on, it becomes more of just a ceremony at the beginning, you know, before a game. But through, you know, really until the team finally won a World Series, this was kind of the pinnacle for Philadelphia Phillies fans, was that 1950 season. So those players, they were always remembered. If you ever saw any of their obituaries, it always lead off of they were a whiz kid. And, you know, fans might walk up to them and not recognize their name, but when they heard they were a whiz kid, oh yeah. And you had fans all over the country knew the whiz kids, and Bobby Knight famously would win bar bets by trying to get people to name the starting lineup of the Phillies, and Mike Goliat would be the one that he would always hold in his back pocket. So they really captured the imagination of Phillies fans. And I think, you know, they had a similar situation in 64 where they were ahead by almost the same amount with the same number of games left. I think it was with 12 days left, but they didn't win that time. And I think the pain, you know, went back to the Whiz Kids who had gone through that and been successful. I think it really built them as kind of the pinnacle for a long time in Philadelphia sports, not just in baseball.
Did any of the players who were on that team make it into the Hall of Fame?
Two have, Robin Roberts and Richie Ashburn, both made the Hall of Fame.
Did you have at any point a chance to meet any of the players?
No, I didn't. I did talk to Ed Sinicki, who again played in 49 and 51 and would have been called up in 1950, but the day he was called up, he broke his ankle. And so I did talk to him many years ago for another project. But unfortunately, I didn't get to. I started working on this just about the time that Kurt Simmons passed away, and he was the last of the living Whiz Kids.
We've been speaking with Dennis Snelling. He is the author of The Whiz Kids, How the 1950 Phillies Took the Pennant, Lost the World Series, and Changed Philadelphia Baseball Forever. Dennis, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Listeners like you make PCN programming possible. Full episodes of PA Books, as well as other PCN programs, are available to stream with the PCN Select app. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.